from the University of Houston. This is an Honors College Profcast. Hi, I'm Richard Armstrong, a professor here at the Honors College. Today we talk about Greek drama. Agamemnon, the great Greek king and general, returns home to Mycenae after many years of fighting the Trojan War. He's ruthlessly murdered by his wife, Clytemnestra, and her lover, Aegisthus. The two lovers then seize the throne. The people of Mycenae are forced to accept this palace revolution and learn to stomach the tyranny to save their skins. Only one person keeps the old king's memory alive, Agamemnon's daughter, Electra. She flouts the powers that be with her continued mourning for her father. She harbors the hope that one day her brother Orestes will return to avenge him. The story of Electra is unusual in that we have three versions, one by each of the three great tragic poets. Aeschylus tells us the story in his Libation Bearers, and Sophocles and Euripides both wrote tragedies titled Electra. Clearly the plight of this compelling heroine stirred the greatest minds in Greece. I spoke earlier about Electra with Casey DeWay, the director of the program in classical studies here at the University of Houston. She's written extensively on Greek literature and has a particular interest in the function of women's lamentation in Greek tragedy. Here's what she had to say. So why do you think there was such an interest in Electra among these ancient tragic poets?
Well, the first thing you have to understand about Electra is that she comes from a cursed family, a family that's been cursed over five generations, going back as far as the figure of Tantalus. But her father was the general Agamemnon in the Trojan War. So this story, the House of Atreus, this whole family is at the center of Greek mythology. And she's just part of that larger story. And her killing of her mother with her brother, that's an episode that by itself is tragic, but fits into an even more tragic whole.
So you think that she's a convenient way to focus on part of this long and grisly story?
Yes, and I think that because of the matricide element, that the daughter kills her mother, that is part of what is so fascinating for the tragedians. What does it take to turn a girl against her mother? If you think that the character of Electra is more interesting than the character of Orestes, and I'm not sure that that was the case among ancient tragedians, because, for example, Aeschylus had Orestes at the heart of his famous Oresteia trilogy. But if you think that later tragedians like Sophocles and Euripides had more interest in Electra than Orestes, I think that might have something to do with the way that tragedy uses female characters in a really interesting way. They really are kind of focused on female characters in a way that would not have been true in normal life. I mean, women in ancient Athens were not supposed to be heard about, were not supposed to make waves. But in tragedy, they take center stage. They speak, they act, they commit murder, they do all kinds of things. And so why, you have to ask yourself, why? Why are female characters so prominent on the tragic stage? And a lot of people have speculated about this. I find a lot of truth in scholars' work who suggest that Greek tragedy used female characters to explore often questions of masculinity and citizenship. It's almost like they use the marginal to explore the central.
Mm-hmm. It's also a big difference from epic, isn't it, in the way that the women take center stage, and especially, in this case, an unmarried woman, even, not a Helen.
You're right, but I think you're absolutely right that it's different from epic. But what's interesting is that a lot of times they take center stage by being extremely female, being extremely traditional female. So what I mean by that is the women of epic that they might think of like Andromache, they make their mark to the extent that they do through the traditional genre of lament. They lament for fallen heroes. They even lament for heroes before they die, but they do so in a very traditional way, using traditional imagery and language that's entirely appropriate for them and sanctioned for them. Then you come to tragedy and you have this surprising situation where the women are stepping outside of their gender roles, but in some ways they're doing it by being, if this makes sense, extremely female. So, like, Electra in Sophocles' play, she laments and she laments and she laments and she laments. And that's entirely expected of her to do that. As the daughter of Agamemnon, she's unmarried. Her primary allegiance is to her father, and she is supposed to lament him. And so that is how she takes action. I've argued recently that her laments are a kind of speech act because they summon the vengeance that comes in the form of Orestes.
Do you think, just in terms of drama, because it is a speech act, something that can be done, presented in the stage as speaking, that this is one of the reasons why, as a dramatist, you might focus on her instead of Orestes, that you can take the emotions and the moment and the tension and express it through lamentation, and then we build up to that moment of action where, you know, he's there and it now can happen.
I do think that that's true, because the fact is that Orestes kills his mother as well, and that's a very disturbing thing to have happen. And if you believe that this play is a tragedy, that is, that it is supposed to arouse emotions of pity and fear, as Aristotle later formulated it, if you think that the emotional dynamic is supposed to be that the audience gets caught up in these events and experiences very, very powerful feelings of grief and fear, and, you know, eventually achieves a kind of what Aristotle called a purification from it, I think the only way that that's possible is if Electra does the laments that she does. If she prepares the audience for what's to come by having them feel the grief that she feels, by having them get angry about what's happened to Agamemnon, by at least identifying with her to a certain extent, so that eventually when the murder comes, it comes naturally and feels justified. You don't have to say that Electra and Orestes are unqualified heroes, that they are praised for their deeds. But I think you have to say that for an audience, they would have felt natural.
Well, if we think again in terms of Aristotle and the idea that tragedy works on feelings of pity and fear, I guess we could say, right, that Electra is a better figure, especially with regard to pity. She's a very pitiful creature. We see her degraded in many ways. And obviously she's in a situation that can invoke fear. There's that sense of threat, whereas Orestes perhaps does not. He's not someone at the outset that we feel we need to pity, right?
That's right. And I think that speaks to the larger function of lament, which for women in this world, lament allowed them to get the pity of the community when they were at their most vulnerable, when they've lost their husband or their father or their male protector in life, and the future is uncertain for them in the funeral context, but also more generally, women had the sanctioned speech of lament to be able to ask for the pity of the community and reach out to them. And so in the play, I think, too, we feel sympathy for Electra because of the state that she's in a way that maybe we couldn't, you're right, for Orestes. And so she really does the job of preparing us for being able to understand this murder and the need for this murder, whereas maybe we couldn't do that if we just saw Orestes.
Is it possible through Electra that we also work out some ambivalence, or do you think that her moral vision, as it were, is simply clear, that this is purely a matter of revenge?
I don't think it's clear. I think we have to say that revenge is an idea that is deeply ingrained in ancient Greek culture, in ancient Greek literature, and every character we ever read about in epic or tragedy, you know, so often they're invoking the need for revenge. But at the same time, the Athenians watching this tragedy were part of a democracy in which there was a court system that handled the case of even murder. So, you know, that was what Aeschylus's Oresteia was all about, which we have to think about when we talk about the Electra, because Sophocles would have known Aeschylus's Oresteia trilogy, which, you know, was about this exact same story. It's the story of Orestes and his revenge on his mother and her lover. And what it does is, it's a trilogy that traces an evolution from a revenge-based system of justice to a court-based system of justice. And it's a really difficult case. This is the most difficult case. It's so difficult that the first jury of this first trial is a hung jury, and Athena has to give the final vote. So even though it's the very first court case, we see how difficult it is. And when Sophocles comes to the story, he's wrestling with these same questions of justice. And he is not a simple tragedian by any means, and I think he does not give us any easy answers. We don't unquestionably praise Electra and Orestes at the end of the play, but we also don't explicitly condemn them. We understand where it came from, and we feel the emotions that went into this act. And we learn something, but it's not something you can easily articulate. That's the difference, I think, between maybe Euripides' version of the Electra and Sophocles's. Euripides is not a simple tragedian either, but he's more explicit in his condemnation of the murder. He actually says, you do just things, but you're not just, in that play. I mean, he says, basically, you achieved justice, but not with justice. And that's kind of a complicated thing, too. But he's definitely more explicit in his condemnation of Electra and Orestes than Sophocles is. So Sophocles definitely doesn't give us any easy answers about this.
I find this very interesting, talking about the Greek way of looking at justice, because, you know, in modern drama, there are so many television shows and popular films about justice and revenge, and yet they're quite different from this Greek mode. What do you think a modern audience might misunderstand about the way in which Greek tragedy deals with these problems of justice?
There have been a lot of studies, anthropological studies, of the notion of revenge in Mediterranean societies. And they suggest that there is an ancient pattern that goes back as far as ancient Greece, if not further, of vendetta. And women played a very important role in this vendetta pattern because they're the ones that sing the songs of lamentation that arouse the feelings of desire for revenge. They're the ones that say, look what has happened to me. Look how I've been wronged. Look how my husband was taken from me. Look at now what's going to happen to me. My child is going to be a beggar. What, you know, how am I going to survive? And that arouses the anger on the community. And they, the men of that community are expected to take action. So the men and women play very defined roles in this vendetta pattern. And like I say, it's a very, very ancient pattern, one that I think would have really resonated with the ancient audience. But like I said before, that ancient audience also has a modern system of justice, a modern court system of justice that is in conflict in some ways with this very ancient vendetta pattern. And sometimes that conflict is made more explicit, so like in Aeschylus's Oresteia, where the first court system is put in place. But you know, in Sophocles, too, we have to understand that he's wrestling with very ancient expectations of gender, especially in this play, Sophocles' Electra. What is expected of you as a woman? What is expected of you as a man? And we have to talk about the figure of Clytemnestra, because, of course, she kind of defies a lot of expectations about gender. She has taken a lover. She seems very masculine in lots of ways. And so it's very interesting to contrast her with Electra and Orestes, who are fulfilling their expected roles.
So you think it's important then to focus, as you said, on Clytemnestra as a sort of anti-type, right? Because if Electra is the one to, you know, wield the knife, she sort of steps out of that role pattern.
Yes, although I have to say, once again, Sophocles does not make it easy for us because we see Clytemnestra experience very maternal feelings at different points in the play. She's happy to hear of Orestes' death, but at the same time, she feels grief because that's her son and she raised him and she nursed him. And so it's really powerful stuff.
You know, I'm thinking about the contradiction between the ancient Greek audience sitting there with their, as you say, modern court system of justice, looking at stories about these old royal families and their sort of hideous vendettas. And, you know, I think we often see this in modern plots where you have a figure, you know, a Dirty Harry or some sort of figure who is going to personalize justice in spite of the bureaucracy and ineptitude of the police department or whatever. And yet, I think there's one big thing missing, even in this modern scenario, that is there in Greek thought, which is that religious element.
That's true.
How do you think that, again, if you think about the ritual foundation of lamentation and the invocation of the gods, would that be maybe a defining difference if we look at drama and in the way it likes to focus on the ambiguities or ambivalence of justice?
I think that's a really, really important point, because Electra and Orestes and Clytemnestra and Agamemnon are all heroes for the ancient Greeks in the religious sense of that word. That is, they are figures of myth that were mortals, human beings who died, but have power after their death. And that power can be accessed by the community that worships them. And one of the things that's the hardest to understand for us is because we have this modern word hero that means someone you admire and praise, or someone who's done good things, someone who's a saint, or even a great basketball player. But we don't have murderers and cursed people as our heroes, right? Well, the ancient Greek word hero had none of that sort of admiration aspect to it. Instead, it really was these powerful figures that had the ability to hurt or harm or even help the community, depending on the relationship between the worshipers and the hero. So there is a huge religious element to it. When we look at the figure of Orestes, he has a lot to do with the idea of coming of age. And the story has a lot to do with coming of age stories for young men, but also for women. And there's a whole other dynamic to it, to the concept of justice, to the concept of revenge and the gods and their role in it, that we have a hard time getting because we don't worship those same gods and heroes anymore ourselves.
Is there any other way in which the modern audience might misread this play? I know that there's been an interesting history of production for Electra, in which case, think of the Strauss opera. She comes out as a full-fledged hysteric. Is there a way in which you see we're prone as moderns to kind of misread and misproduce this play?
Yes, I do, because we are not a vendetta culture in the United States, or really anywhere in Western Europe anymore. And we don't understand that Electra is fulfilling a very expected role in her laments. The people in the play often tell her, "Don't lament," but we don't understand why they're telling her that. We think they're saying, "Oh, you've lamented too much. It's enough
already.
It's enough already with all the whining and the crying. You know, get over it." But that's not what they're saying. They actually fear her laments, because her laments have power. They have the power, like I say, to summon vengeance. They are a speech act that has real consequences. And so when people are saying, when Aegisthus and Clytemnestra threaten to confine her in a rocky cave so that no one can hear her laments, it's because they fear their consequences. And so I think the temptation to portray Electra as a hysterical woman who's someone who is just can't stop crying is really modern and not in keeping with the ancient understanding of what Electra's role is as the unmarried oldest daughter of Agamemnon, and also of the power of lamentation. We just don't have that same force attributed to it anymore in our culture.
So I guess what a cue here for anyone interested in producing Electra would be to focus on lamentation as a speech act, which, works two directions. One, to the human community, those who might be responsible for the vengeance, but also going up to the gods, right? She's saying something that in her speech act gets the attention of the gods and therefore further cause for dread, right?
I think that's right. And then I think there's also a third dimension, which is the audience. I think the audience of the play needs to feel her pain. That's what lament does. It allows them to feel it, and it allows them to go through the emotional arc that they need to go through to understand the vengeance that comes at the end of the play.
Well, you've spoken very well here as a scholar, but I'm wondering, what's your personal connection to this Electra story?
Well, when I was around 12 years old, maybe 13, I'm trying to think, I played the role of Clytemnestra in a a version of Euripides' Electra. And I loved it because I always really identified with Clytemnestra.
Really?
I did, because I looked at it from the perspective of her husband, Agamemnon, killed their daughter, Iphigenia. He told her that she was getting married to Achilles, the greatest of all the heroes and the sexiest and the most, you know, handsome and the best warrior. And he brings her to Aulis in her wedding gown at the height of youth and beauty. And she's at the peak of her life and then sacrifices her to get the winds that they have to get to go to Troy and fight the Trojan War. And I always saw the story from Clytemnestra's perspective and the grief that she must have felt in myth, you know, the grief she would feel and how she would internalize that and have that turn into a rage that simmers for 10 years, right? And when he comes home, she's just waiting for him. And also, you know, at that young age, I had also read the Iliad and disliked Agamemnon very much because he seems like such a
blowhard.
A blowhard, exactly. And I totally, you know, sympathized with Achilles, again, at this young age of like 12. So I was happy to be Clytemnestra, even though in Sophocles and Euripides and Aeschylus, she is very demonized, and you want her to die when you see those plays. But I think that's the most amazing thing about tragedy is that you can go from a play like Iphigenia at Aulis, where you feel Clytemnestra's pain, to the next stage in the story when you feel Electra's and Orestes' pain and want now Clytemnestra to die. And that's what Aeschylus' Oresteia does so brilliantly, is takes you through the whole story. But even when you watch the play of Electra by Sophocles, I think an ancient audience at some level is still sympathetic to Clytemnestra, even while they feel the justice of her death.
So maybe that would be a good project for a modern poet to write the Lamentations of Clytemnestra. Right? We could fill out the story that way.
I think it would be beautiful. And I have to say, I have to recommend Kakayanis's film version of Iphigenia that he did in the 70s. Irene Pappas plays Clytemnestra, and she gets the anger of Greek lament that I think is sometimes strange for a modern audience. It's hard for us to, it's almost scary for us to see a Greek woman, a modern Greek woman, lamenting with so much anger and so much emotion, but we really get who Clytemnestra is and why she does what she does by watching Irene Pappas play her in that film.
Well, thanks for the recommendation, and thanks for the conversation.
Thank you.